All you need is love, love. All you need is a good voltmeter, a soldering iron, and a schematic or two. Welcome to another lovey-dovey episode of Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by eejournal.com. I'm Amelia Dalton, your hostess for today's Innovation Love-a-thon. This week, we're talking about our love of innovation, big and small. From Crossbar's recent breakthrough in non-volatile RAM memory technology to the latest news from the land of Raspberry Pi. From makers to the most experienced engineers out there, this here podcast has a little bit for all y'all. So let's get started. My first guest is Sagar Jatani from Element 14. Sagar is here to bring the goods on the new Raspberry Pi 2 Model B. Wondering how it compares with the Pis of the past? Curious about its quad cores? Hang on to your hats, ladies and gentlemen. We're about to get hot and heavy with the Raspberry Pi 2. Hi, Sagar. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Amelia.
Everyone loves a sequel. So, Sagar, tell me what are the biggest differences between the Raspberry Pi Model B Plus and this new Pi 2 Model B?
Sure. Well, I guess the obvious biggest difference is that the new Model 2 has a much more powerful processor. The original Raspberry Pi, as with its successor, the B+, they both had a Broadcom BCM2835. That's a perfectly solid chip. It runs the ARM version 6 instruction set, and it was suitable for a wide range of applications, which I think was part of the reason why Raspberry Pi became such a phenomenon. People didn't expect to see this much computing power in such a small credit card-sized case. The new Raspberry Pi 2 that we just announced, however, it has a BCM2836, which is able to run the version 7 instruction set. So, for instance, some things that you can now do with that would be to run Windows. Microsoft just announced last week that it is going to make a copy of Windows 10 available to all Raspberry Pi 2 owners for free. That simply wouldn't have worked on the previous generation of Broadcom chips the Raspberry Pi used. We're also running the new Raspberry Pi 2 much faster. It's now a quad core, and it runs at 900 megahertz. We've also doubled the onboard RAM from 512 megabytes to a gig. So it's a monster. It's a significant upgrade that I don't think a lot of people anticipated, especially as the Model B Plus was just announced 6 or 7 months ago. So it's one of those nice cases where you're able to give the market a very pleasant surprise they weren't expecting.
All right. Are the accessories that I have on my bench right now for my Model B Plus compatible with this new model?
So that's a great question, and it was one that was very important to us to get right. So the short answer is yes. All the B Plus accessories are compatible with the Raspberry Pi 2. And in fact, when our team was designing the Raspberry Pi 2 pages on Element 14, we had to look at our Raspberry Pi accessories page, and we thought, well, we want to make it clear which accessories are compatible with which board. So should we make a special avatar or icon showing which of the B Plus accessories will work on the Model 2? And as soon as we looked at the data, we said, you know what? We can just use a single icon because as long as it's compatible with the B+, it works on the Pi 2 as well. So yes, all that investment you may have made in your peripherals is safe. And we hope to be able to offer very soon a host of brand new peripherals that really take advantage of the horsepower that this new Raspberry Pi 2 has to offer.
So I heard that a micro SD card is going to become available for the Pi 2. Is that right?
Yeah, you heard correctly. Absolutely right. You know, one of the things we learned with the previous Raspberry Pis was there are always folks out there who will prefer to go and download the OS and prepare their SD cards and flash them and all of that setup that's required. But then there are also a lot of people for whom that can be a little intimidating. Maybe they're not quite as comfortable with the technology and the processes as other people. So we offered for the previous generation of Raspberry Pis a solution called NOOBS. It stands for New Out-of-the-Box Software. And what was great about Noobs is if you didn't know anything about how to flash an SD card, it was okay. All you had to do was plug that SD card in, and when you turned on the Raspberry Pi, you would be presented with a menu asking which OS you'd like to boot into. Everything from Raspbian, which is, of course, the Raspberry Pi's recommended operating system, but going all the way back to Arch Linux, if you really want to go old school, and several options in between. And people really liked that a lot. That was a really popular product for us. So we want to offer the same thing now with the Raspberry Pi 2. And we're working on getting those ready just as soon as possible. And hopefully, you know, very soon on Element 14, you'll see those cards becoming available.
Okay, let's put this in a bit more broad of a focus. Now, what is Element 14's involvement with the Pi Foundation?
Sure, that's a great question. So Element 14 is a community for electronic engineers and for builders and people who make things. We've been around for about 5 years now, and in that time we've grown to over 300,000 members globally. These are people who are obsessed about building things. So things that we do when we have a community like that is design competitions. We try to bring creative approaches to solve age-old problems. And we try to take the collective intelligence of our community and apply it to fixing things around the world that need fixing. So our involvement with the Raspberry Pi Foundation began right at the start, where we were one of the few original distributors of the original Raspberry Pi in 2012, February 29th, 2012, a day that will live in hardware infamy. So we were there at the very start, seeing the incredible demand that existed out there for the Raspberry Pi. And early on, we also struggled to meet that demand by making enough product available and trying to satisfy all the orders that were coming in. Along the way, we built up a very nice, very sizable Raspberry Pi community on the Element 14 website. So what's great about that is, you know, the Raspberry Pi is pitched towards people who either are fluent with the technology but want to introduce others to computing, or for those who just want to get into it themselves for the first time. There's a very big educational component to the Raspberry Pi Foundation's mission. And I think the way that Element 14's community ties into that is that you're not alone. If you buy a Raspberry Pi 2 and you're a little bit intimidated, maybe you're not quite sure how to get started exactly or what projects to begin, you can join our community for free and come across dozens and dozens of projects that will give you an idea of what to do, as well as hundreds of members who are available pretty much around the clock to help answer any questions you might have.
And here's the clincher, Sagar. How much is this new Pi 2, and where can I get my hands on one?
Yeah, so this is the part we love, you know, because we're so used to seeing new products coming out, whether it's a gaming console or a TV, and sure, there's always more features because that's what the market demands, but there's usually always a higher price. In this case, we get to go against that trend. The new Raspberry Pi 2, with all of its advantages over the old model, costs exactly the same amount. It's $35. That's excluding sales tax and shipping and handling, but it's $35, the same as the previous generation. And that was really important, I think, for the foundation and for us to be able to do and to get that right, because, again, this is aimed at an educational market, at a building-making market. We want to make sure that it's priced accordingly so that it remains as accessible as possible. In terms of where you can get it, that's also very easy. Just jump over to element14.com. If you go to our homepage, you'll see it big and beautiful right on the top there, Raspberry Pi 2. And we sell globally as well. So it doesn't matter if you're going to element14.com from North America, from Europe, from Middle East, what have you, you will be directed to the purchasing outlet that's most appropriate for you.
Excellent. I am going to go there now.
Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me. It was super cool.
Oh, thank you. It's such a pleasure. Hey, I mentioned at the top of the call that I was a fan of the show, and this is a total non sequitur, but I had to share this with you. I teach guitar a little bit, and when I was told that there was an opportunity to be on Fish Fry, I took out that guitar and I played this. So, I just had to share.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, that's so great. I love it.
I had a great time. Thank you so much for inviting us to be here.
Next up, let's get tiny, but pack a big old punch. My next guest is Sylvain Dubois from crossbar. Sylvana's here to give us an update on the non-volatile memory landscape and how Crossbar's RM memory technology fits into that picture. He'll also tell us how Crossbar managed to solve their sneak path current problem. Doesn't everyone have that problem? I mean, really. Let's go. Hi, Sylvan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Amelia.
So, Sylvan, give my audience a refresher on what do you guys do? What is Crossbar all about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been about a year and a half since we came out of stealth mode, and that was in August 2013. So Crossbar executed pretty well on the plan and timing that we outlined them. If you remember, we had a two-phase approach. The first phase was on IP licensing for embedded resistive RAM integrated in microcontrollers for basically IoT application, wearables. And we already started the second phase of product development for identity storage applications. So we are currently transferring our technology, our resistive RAM technology, to the foundries, and we're ready to start the commercialization phase.
Excellent. So you guys recently announced that you tackled a huge problem that has been vexing the alternative memory solutions market for some time now. So tell my audience exactly what that technical challenge was and how you beat it.
We addressed two major technical challenges last year. The first one was the selectivity features, and the second one was the sneak path current, as you mentioned. The selectivity features of our resistive RAM cell makes it possible for a single transistor to connect with a very large number of memory cells. We're talking about thousands of memory cells. That's what we call the 1TNR arrays. That enables very dense memories. The sneak path current is also a major challenge of the crossbar array. And with the performance and the characteristics of the selectivity features that we announced and that I just mentioned, we can suppress these sneak path currents that interferes with reliable reading of data from individual memory cells. And that's exactly what we announced last December at IADM. And this will enable us to address the very high density, low power memory arrays.
Okay, cool. Crossbar is a relatively small company, but it's in a field of very large memory companies. So what do you think gives Crossbar a leg up in the industry?
So these other big players, they are currently working on flash-based technology. Flash is facing clear challenges on the scalability path in terms of performances, program array cycles, which we call endurance, and data retention. Manufacturing is also a big challenge for flash. 3D NAND manufacturing cost is big. So in our case, crossbar resistive RAM is not suffering these scalability challenges. And as we use startup CMOS processes, any semiconductor fab can license and produce our technology.
So it seems like you guys have quite a lot going for you right now. What's in the future for Crossbar?
So future for us is first to continue to execute very clearly on our plan. We have to complete the transfer of our technology to our manufacturing foundry partners. That's a top priority. We have to ramp up the development and production of our embedded IP solutions for IoT application and wearables. And we also have to continue to drive the standalone storage solution work.
Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me, Sylvan. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Amelia.
Now, folks, let's talk about the love of analog components. Wait, you don't love analog just about anything? Yeah, join the club. Unless you're still rocking that mullet and own more tie-dyes than actual ties, you know who you are. But let's face it, even if we don't like it very much, eventually most of our designs need to control something in the real world. And that means we have to bust out of our safe little digital realm and drive some analog actuators or something like that. But do you really want to build that analog output section from scratch? Yeah. I didn't think so. Well, for all you analog output newbies out there, you should really check out our recent episode of Chalk Talk entitled Accelerating Your Analog Output Design. In this episode of Chalk Talk, I sit down with Bill Laumeister from Maxim Integrated to talk about the Analog Output Design Accelerator Kit, a complete platform for easy evaluation that requires no lab equipment. Bam. You can check out this episode by clicking the link below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, by heading on over to the front page of eejournal.com. It's in the player, right on the right-hand side, below the fold. You can't miss it. Or by heading on over to YouTube, keyword eejournal. And hey, when you're on ye olde YouTube, you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. That way, each and every episode of Chalk Talk will be automatically delivered right to your door. Or inbox, as the case may be. Oh, hey, also, I want to mention that Maxim Integrated, in association with our new Chalk Talk, is hosting an Analog Output Design Accelerator Kit contest. Yes, from February 9th until March 6th. I've included a link that will take you right to that page as well. Yeah, because I'm nice like that. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can also monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And hey, if Google Plus is your thing, then I'm sorry. No, you can also join our circle on Google Plus. We also have that YouTube channel I mentioned earlier, keyword EE Journal, chock full of all kinds of techie videos, our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series, and our video series called On the Scene. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can also grab our Fish Frying RSS feed or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or perhaps the best geeky hotspot in your city, because I love that stuff, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of February 13th, 2015, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.